Hi, everybody, and happy 420! We've got an all-new episode for you today with a very special guest, and it's dropping like it's glowy hot on a weedness day that also happens to be 420 Eve. Special thanks to Reggie Watts for playing us in with his 420 song, which he first performed a few years ago on the Late Late Show on CBS, where he serves as the resident band leader. You can listen to my interview with Reggie Watts by scrolling down just a little bit in the archives of this podcast. This year on 420, I'm going to be in Los Angeles for the High Holiday, where I'll be hosting a live weed trivia contest at a futuristic arcade called 2-Bit Circus. Check out 420experience.com for more on that free event and come get lit with me if you're in LA. Meanwhile, welcome to our official Great Moments in Weed History 420 special episode. You better believe we're gonna get high AF for this one, especially considering our guest this weed is none other than Danny Danko, a world-renowned cannabis cultivation expert, a big friend of this podcast, who has joined the sesh specifically to encourage you all to grow your own weed this year. That's right, it is time to overgrow the government. Now, before the black helicopters descend upon our remote, off-the-grid, Great Moments in Weed History fortified broadcast compound, let me stop and stress that what I just said was we need to overgrow the government, G-R-O-W, grow. It's a simple idea. If we all grow enough weed to smoke ourselves silly and to share with friends and family and patients in need, then we can end cannabis prohibition and keep corporate cannabis in check. Plus, as Dan's about to explain, growing your own is a fun, life-affirming hobby that will save you lots of money and leave you with an overabundance of the best weed on earth. The weed you grew yourself. But before we get into it, let me offer a very special 420 thank you to our growing community of supporters on Patreon who keep this podcast on the air by throwing in on this shit so we can all get high on history together. You can join us right now by visiting greatmomentsinweedhistory.com and signing up for incredible bonuses like the video version of every episode, special secret sessions just for supporters, and even a signed copy of my book, How to Smoke Pot Properly, all at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com. Make it your 420 present to yourself this year. Now, let's talk about Danny Danko. Dan and I met at the very beginning of my time as a professional weed guy. I'd just landed a job at High Times Magazine, back when it was cool, and while I smoked weed every day back then and loved weed with all my heart, I honestly didn't know that much about it, really. Particularly, I was in the dark about how the plant grows, its biochemistry, the differences between different strains, and the incredible underground network of outlaw cultivators that kept cannabis alive and thriving as the government tried so very hard to eradicate this miraculous medicinal plant. Dan taught me about all of that and so much more. Together, we traveled to amazing farms and gardens all over the world, working to help spread knowledge about this plant far and wide, while always learning ourselves from the countless brilliant growers and breeders we encountered. In addition to being a hell of a lot of fun, this felt like a truly revolutionary act. The articles we wrote and the videos we made were straight up banned in many countries. Looking back, I'm really proud that Dan and I tried to overgrow the government together, and 2 decades later, we're both still at it. Dan is currently the editor of Northeast Leaf magazine. He's the author of Cannabis, A Beginner's Guide to Growing Marijuana, and he hosts the always top shelf podcast, Grow Bud Yourself with Danny Danko. And so what could be more appropriate to kickstart our interview and this year's 420 special than puffing on my own homegrown out of my own PAX vaporizer? Last week on this podcast, when we rehashed the history of 420, you heard me welcome the iconic PAX Vaporizer as our newest sponsor. We are truly blessed to be working with this amazing product and company that I've been such a big fan of for so many years. So stay tuned after the theme song to hear all about PAX, including a special discount code available only to Great Moments in Weed History listeners like you. But what if you're not yet lit and you haven't had time to order your very own PAX just yet, and you're like, oh wow, man, it's the 420 episode and Danny Danko is in the house and Bean is about to puff PAX, and I'm not where I need to be just yet, my friend. Just chill. Hit pause and use that time to go to PAX.com and get yourself a PAX. And while you wait for that to come direct to you in the mail, you can use that time on pause to roll yourself a joint, to split a blunt, to pack a bong, to endabulate a dab. I am about to hit this PAX that just lit up for me, or to eat as much edibles as you think it's wise to do so, keeping in mind it's 420 and we should all call out of work and just get lit all day. One thing I can promise you, my friends and compatriots, is that when you hit unpause, because you are lit up and ready, we'll all be lit up and ready as well for another great moment in weed history. You know, it's no exaggeration to say this podcast runs on coffee and weed. And lately, the coffee has been top shelf because of our new sponsor, Vigilante Coffee. I grind my beans daily, no pun intended, and I do the whole pretentious hipster pour over thing every morning. And I gotta say, I really enjoy thinking about where my coffee came from and how it was grown and processed, just like weed. And just like weed, it's worth it to get the best coffee you can afford. And the good news is, if you brew your own at home, really good coffee is an affordable luxury. That's why I'm thrilled to have Vigilante Coffee on the podcast and in my mug each and every morning. Vigilante is a specialty coffee roaster that sources their beans directly from small, award-winning farms around the world and then roasts them to perfection. They support ending the war on drugs, and they want to support this podcast too, because they believe that all you really need is coffee and weed. Amen. So treat yourself to a bag of their Golden Bean Award-winning Dank blend, which has just returned for its fourth year. Dank is 80% Guatemalan and 20% Ethiopian. Brew that up nice and strong and pair it with a puff or two of good weed in the morning, and I guarantee you will be up and at them. To learn more or to order their amazing coffee, check out their website, vigilantecoffee.com, or you can visit one of their cafes. And if you buy a pound of those beans, well, please tell them Bean sent you. VigilanteCoffee.com. Danny Danko, I am thrilled and honored to have you here. I think as our first ever return guest on Great Moments in Weed History, you taught me everything I ever really needed to know about cannabis as I came into the community. You continue to teach the world how to cultivate this magnificent plant that we both love. And of course, a happy 420 to you as well. So psyched that you're here.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for that introduction. It's an honor and a pleasure, and always great to catch up with great old friends and colleagues.
We started a tradition here of kind of asking our guests to tell us the first time they smoked or ingested cannabis as question number one. But I'm going to switch that up a little bit here. And I'm going to ask you about the first time, whatever came of it or didn't, the first time that you attempted to grow your own cannabis.
Okay, this is a good one. I had a room growing up that had sort of a little side room off of it that we kind of called the Love Shack. And but it did get a lot of sunshine in that room because there was a lot of windows. And basically started up some bag seed in a tub, like a plastic tub, when I was probably, I want to say 16 or 17, just kind of getting out of high school and starting college. I grew this plant. I actually still have pictures of this. It was a plant. I didn't even get to figure out if it was male or female, really. It grew to about a foot and a half tall in that space. And then my mother discovered it and freaked out on me. Typical Russian mom. You know, the idea was basically like, you cannot do that in this house. And I ended up moving out and moving in with some buddies. So it was kind of the impetus for me to get out of my parents' house in a weird way. I mean, they had found like a triple beam scale. They had found, to this day, I think my mom thinks, you know, a half a pound is like $5 worth of cannabis. Because you know, I don't think she could fathom that it wasn't for personal use. But earlier I had seen my friend John, he had a legit grow room, basically just a closet. But that was really kind of what opened my eyes to the fact that you didn't need fields in Central or South America to produce cannabis. And it could actually be a higher quality if you did it right in this very small space. You know, you got to plant seeds to get started. And I planted some seeds and figured things out and then eventually got better at it over time. But that was the first plant, was not such a great experience, but also in retrospect kind of kicked off my career in a weird way.
Yeah, I would say it's kind of a not a coming of age but a coming of gauge moment for you. It sets a trajectory for your life. And of course, you know, I know that you're all good with your mom and your family. It wasn't,
oh yeah, funny story. Funny story, my mom just told me a couple of days ago, she was asking about help sleeping. She's 80, she's in her 80s, and she was asking for cannabis for sleep purposes. And I put her, she has a dispensary literally like half a block from her where she lives in Brookline. And I basically gave her a little list and sent her on her way with her friend. And they were rejected from entry because they didn't have a valid identification, I think. My mother got such a huge kick out of the fact that she couldn't get into the dispensary. She's eight, you know, her and her friend, both in their 80s, old, you know, Russian ladies. So they had a laugh with the security guard and, of course, eventually went back with her passport and proper ID and got what she wanted and is a cannabis user, you know, which is crazy because, like I said, she had kicked me out, you know, 30 some years ago and came around now.
Listening back to your story in my mind, I realize it sets us in a time and place. It was an era of triple beam scales and bag seed. So you might have to explain to the kids what both of those concepts are.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And beepers. Yeah, absolutely. There was a whole different terminology back then and secrecy that you had to go along with as well. A lot of trust amongst outlaws, family, freedom, you know, personal freedom were at risk. And it's now to look back on all of that. It's just been a wild ride. But again, when people say, oh, I wish it was still like that back in the day. I mean, certainly we had good times, but you can't forget that people's lives were destroyed and people were shot and thrown in jail and irrevocably harmed by prohibition. So do have to remind younger people that, you know, it wasn't just all fun and games. There was a lot at risk and at stake.
Yeah, absolutely. When you hear about people were getting $5,000 a pound for outdoor cannabis, well, that's the prohibition subsidy. Those prices were artificially high because of the risk that you were assuming. That really gets to the theme of this episode. We're out to overgrow, using my words and enunciating very carefully. Hear me, AI bots. Overgrow the government. And, you know, by that we mean the more non-commodified cannabis there is in the world that's outside of the economic system. It can still be perfectly legal depending where you live, but it's not going to be taxed. It's not going to go through bureaucracy. It's not going to be subject to all these government regulations. I grew up in New Jersey. In mid-August in New Jersey, everybody with a vowel at the end of their name has 8 to 10 times more tomatoes than they could possibly use. Tomatoes become decommodified, and it is a beautiful thing as you just can gift this treasure from your backyard. You're somebody who really speaks to the growers out there. Do you see people embracing this idea? Do you, like, is the home grow movement on the rise, or are people more looking to shop at the store?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little of both, but also, as you mentioned, like the price during Prohibition was in the risk. Well, now if you go to a licensed shop, the price is in the taxes and in the production cost, you know, the air conditioning and the lighting and these big warehouses, and all, you're still paying $50 or $60 an eighth when it all comes down to it from a shop. But if you grow your own, it's pennies to the dollar. And there's also, you know, these seshes and these sort of underground farmers market type events, which I champion as well. It's like with food or with anything else, people are always talking about local, small batch. These are all of those things. These are home growers, basically, who have excess cannabis, and you can buy it in a jar at the farmer's market, which I would definitely prefer to, you know, mass-produced cannabis that is made in a big warehouse using up all kinds of carbon and all emissions and all of that. So I would prefer sun-grown, local, organic, you know, farm-grown, basically home-style cannabis. And if I wasn't even going to grow it myself, I'd still rather purchase it from that type of marketplace personally. Now, that's not to say those, you know, the dispensaries shouldn't exist. I think, you know, for people who just want vape pen or gummies or flower that, you know, they're not going to consume on a daily basis like the way real connoisseurs and aficionados do, that's there, you know, obviously that has a right to exist. But I do think there should be an outlet for home growers to, you know, sell at these farmers markets and to share. Like you said, if it's an overabundance, it's time to start sharing with friends and family and really enjoying this healing flower.
And the other thing is, if we reach this point, as more and more people are allowed to legally grow, that there is more and more abundance in this legal but non-commodified market, that's going to create pressure on the dispensary market to lower their prices. In a lot of states that allow home grow, 6 plants is kind of a standard. It does vary state to state. And of course, there are places, very limited places, where, and I don't consider this legalization, where it's legal, but you can't grow it yourself, I think is kind of bullshit. But for the people who can grow 6 plants outdoors, if you have a little sunny space to do that, if you're going to really put in some thought and do it right, but you don't have a lot of experience, what's a reasonable yield from that?
I think anywhere between a quarter and a half pound per plant outdoors in decent full sun, that when it's properly watered and taken care of, that's, you know, kind of on the lower end of what you can get. And then obviously the sky's the limit. What's interesting about plant limits is the limit is on the amount of plants, but not on the size of the plants. And with cannabis, you control the size of the plant when you decide to start flowering. So you can have a longer vegetative time and a bigger container if you're container gardening or outdoors, you know, a nice deep hole. You can elongate the vegetative time so that you get a much larger plant and a much larger yield as well.
Doing some quick math, if you were getting a half pound off of 6 plants, and here we're not talking about maxing everything out. We're talking about, you know, something that would fit in a backyard and maybe be below the level of your fence. That's 3 pounds of, if you choose to, organic, small batch, delicately handled cannabis. That's a lot of weed, man. And
oh yeah,
and you can go, as you say, much bigger than that. The phrase you used once was a double overhead plants that are now Dan and I aren't the tallest the tallest yardsticks out there, but you know, we have in our adventures together had the pleasure of being among plants that were fully mature and twice as tall as we are, 10 feet and change. How much can you get off of those plants that you might see in a picture or a video from Humboldt County?
Multiple pounds. I mean, 5 to 10 pounds. Those plants are started indoors. In the wintertime, they're grown until they're about, you know, knee to chest high before they're even placed outside in the spring. And then they have, you know, the spring and summer to stay in that vegetative stage, growing branches and leaves. And then in the fall, they flower for another 2 months until you harvest them, you know, end of September, early October. So, you know, the multiple pounds, and then that's just dry flower. That's not considering all of the trim that you're trimming off and being able to make concentrates from the trim, edibles from that. Some people even juice fresh cannabis leaves, which is, you know, another thing that, you know, you can't really buy at a dispensary, right? That's like only the grower really has access to that sort of thing. And then, of course, scissor hash and all those things we talk about that are really basically head stash that, you know, the grower basically holds on to for special occasions. So there's a lot that you can get out of those plants, not just the dry flower, but other things as well. It's pretty good. And you can stock up and have jars in a cool, dark place that last you year round without ever having to pay for, you know, anything but, you know, maybe a few bags of soil or some plant foods. And it's fun, too. I mean, I should also mention, like, it's an incredibly fun and enjoyable hobby. And for people that are medical patients, I think also there's no feeling like creating your own medicine and then being able to consume that and not having to spend top dollar for something that's higher quality too. I mean, I would say 99% of cannabis that's available for purchase is overfed, underflushed, not dried and cured properly the way that a home grower would. You know, if your interest is in quality and potency and effect, there's nothing better than your own homegrown.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. I people always ask me, what's your favorite kind of weed? And I jokingly say, whatever you've got to share. But what I really mean is hopefully whatever you grew yourself. Your only orientation towards those six plants, if that's what you're lucky to have, is quality. Also, extend that beyond the life of the plant. What happens to commercial cannabis from the time it gets cut down until it reaches a jar on the dispensary shelf versus that same process for a home grower? Can you talk about like the differences and how that would reflect in the quality of what you end up with?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's about the drying and curing process, which you can't really fake and you can't really rush. So that's something that, you know, the home grower is in control of. Another thing I should mention is genetics. I mean, there's so much renaming going on. You don't really know for sure what you're getting if you're purchasing it, whether it be on the licensed market or underground, because whatever is the hype name is what people will call whatever they've got. The only way to really be sure is to grow your own. If there's one thing I've learned in all these years, I mean, the scaling up, it results in higher quantity, but lower quality. The small six plant gardens are always going to be better than the 100 square foot warehouse bud. It's just you know, it's almost impossible to maintain quality on that scale. So it's the same kind of thing as with almost any other commodity that people care about. The highest quality is made in the smallest quantities.
Clear parallels in wine, in beer,
mm-hmm. Cigars.
Cigars, high-end spirits. So it, you know, there's a woo-woo-ness to it, but you don't have to embrace the woo-woo-ness of it to just look and see what are the most valued and expensive wines. They're all going to come from smaller vineyards.
Yeah, well, the terpenes are very volatile. These are the essential oils that are basically what you're trying to preserve, where the cannabinoids flavonoids and terpenoids are contained. And that easily breaks off. I mean, that's the powder that you see at the bottom of a bag of really good bud. That's the hash that, that's the dry sieve that you press and make into hashish concentrate. So attempting to preserve that, you really can't have temperatures higher than 80 degrees because some of them are volatile even at that temperature. Our job is basically to preserve those flavonoids and terpenoids and cannabinoids as well as possible in a cool, dark place, drying and curing properly, and then storing properly as well. Light and heat are your enemy. Any kind of beating up of the buds with a machine is going to knock off a lot of that psychoactive material that is really what you're trying to save. So really the homegrown that's never been pressed into bricks and or any of that other stuff is always going to be much, much, much better, flavorful, potent, burn properly, and just have the best effect.
Just to hit this point one more time, when you say pennies on the dollar, you are not exaggerating. If we're talking about just that 3 pounds of cannabis, you might be able to get reasonably from six backyard plants, and you start to add up, well, what would that cost buying it an eighth at a time from the dispensary versus, you need dirt. You need some basic fertilizer. You need sunshine that you hopefully have access to. Of course, we recognize that some people, live in housing that doesn't give them that opportunity. And if you're hearing this and feeling like I'm not able to do this, definitely understood. But also maybe you have a friend who does have the right place to do it and you can work together on this. But it is like a sec. If you smoke a lot of weed, growing your own weed is like a gig economy for yourself because the time that you put into this is going to be very financially rewarded in savings. And also, too late, obviously, this episode is going to come out just before 420, but imagine 420 next year and you are the person with abundance and you are able to gift your friends and strangers this beautiful cannabis that you've grown. What is that feeling like?
Yeah, well, there's nothing like it. Like you said, outdoor is practically free. I mean, especially nowadays, with living soil, being able to basically improve on your soil by adding organic material, composting, and things like that, less and less inputs are necessary at that point. So that's great. Even indoors, though, for the price of a grow tent, a decent light, and a little bit of equipment, some fans and monitors and things, it pays you back in the first harvest. Very, very quickly. And if people are worried about space, there are tents as small as 2 by 2, 4 by 4, smaller than a refrigerator, in which you can definitely grow plenty of cannabis. And you can have your six plants in there and hand water them. No need to go for these expensive hydro systems that come with some of these tents. That's you're paying for a bunch of plastic that's unnecessary, really. It's not that complicated. I always recommend for beginners to start with the most forgiving of techniques, which is basically just a nice airy soilless mix, or peat-based mix, and just hand water in a bucket with, a few holes in the bottom. That's much easier than trying to learn all the complicated reservoir maintenance that's required for hydroponics. It doesn't require a lot of space. And it certainly doesn't require hours and hours of work. Only when you come across certain difficulties that arise, deficiencies, pests, molds, and things that you just learn from dealing with over time. But there's a way to fix almost every problem. So it's really just a matter of diligence. And if you enjoy it, you will be rewarded.
If it sounds like a chore, then maybe it will feel like a chore, but I can say from my personal experience, it feels like a relationship. It feels like caretaking, and it's going to be a mutually beneficial relationship. Cannabis, particularly outdoors, it grows quickly, and it's inspiring in that way to sort of step out in the morning, whether you've got a cup of coffee, a mate, or you know, whatever gets your morning going, to see that plant and to see that it's a little bigger than yesterday, and also has a cycle with the seasons. To see a plant that starts small every spring, we should say, these are annual plants. So they live their whole life cycle out from spring to fall. And there's something beautiful and connecting about that.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I appreciate the seasons far more since starting with this process. I never was a green thumb prior to this. And now I have houseplants all over the house and in any place I can find to put them. I take cuttings of my houseplants as well. So I learned cloning and things, techniques that can be used throughout, you know, a lot of other plants. And it's really put me in tune with nature and the way that the cycles work and life and death and all of it. It's really a grounding experience. And I think, you know, all gardening is that way, but cannabis gardening in particular. I would say, like Ed and a lot of people say, it's cannabis isn't addictive, but growing it can be.
I will co-sign that. Okay, we've talked up till now about people who have some legal access to home grow. Keeping in mind the statute of limitations and everything, most of your experience of growing cannabis and most of the cannabis that most of us came up smoking was illicit. I draw no moral distinction whatsoever. And if anything, I think somebody who is willing to take those risks to provide this plant in a time of prohibition is to be celebrated. That said, don't get caught. Don't put yourself in a position to get caught. Don't take risks without understanding the potential consequences. You know, I think some of the most upsetting stories of all, in our days back in high times and since are people who didn't realize how severe the penalties might have been for what they were doing. And so please take that seriously. I would never tell anybody not to grow weed. I'm not a fucking narc. I'm not the government. But I will tell you, as Shay said, the first responsibility of any revolutionary is to not get caught. And that's absolutely true when it comes to cannabis.
There's places you can still get life in prison in the United States. There's places in the world where you can be executed for this, cultivation of this healing flower. It's a wonderful, amazing hobby, but it does still have risks in many places. I myself stay within my limits here in New York. I have my medical card. I do my 6 plants per person, 12 plants per household. It's funny because, you know, even now I talk to people like ChemDog and friends of ours who were part of that. And I just recently at AnyCan, I said to him, isn't it nice that we can do this now without having to look over our shoulders? And he looked at me and he said, yeah, but I still do. Since it's like this, you know, post-traumatic stress that we have that's ingrained in us over all those years of hiding and being afraid, basically having that looming over us and it's still there.
And of course, if you want to check out our episode of Great Moments in Weed History, where we interviewed ChemDog and traced his journey from finding some magic beans on Deadlot to bringing one of the iconic strains of modern cannabis to the people. Going back to the beginning of your cultivation journey, Dan, I would like to now ask you, what was the first successful in terms of producing cannabis grow and how did you get to there?
Okay, that's a good one too. Did some experimenting in the Boston area, like I said, with some bag seed, and then working up to basically kind of a closet sized grow with a small light. And then when I moved to New York, basically around 95 is when I started basically thinking, okay, I need to step this up a little bit. New York is an expensive place to live, and there was a thriving culture here at the time. Even, you know, the delivery services were a big thing. Giuliani had basically started to take over. City government shut down a lot of the outdoor weed spots. So it became a delivery service culture in a lot of ways, at least for the highest end quality. And so the first successful grow that I had was actually underneath the platform of a skateboard ramp, a half pipe that was in a loft building in here in Brooklyn. I had a lot of friends that were skateboarders. These lofts were basically one of the great places to do this sort of thing, typically in very industrial areas with lots of space to work with. And so, yeah, I started out just the space underneath the skateboard half pipe that was in my friend Dan's loft. And that was the first real success that I had. I grew a mother plant in there and I had my flowering plants. And, you know, while you're working in there, people are skating the half pipe. It's very loud sometimes, you know, and if people were skating at the same time as I was under there. But then I sort of moved my way up into a whole room sized grows until eventually what I thought was a big grow, you know, 16 lights, eight and eight on each side with the ballast flipper in New York City, you know, that was big at the time. And certainly would have resulted in a lot of bad things if it was discovered. But, you know, I was very lucky, very careful, and managed to succeed with that.
What are the strains of the era? Ramp OG or, you know, what do you remember growing at that time?
I had gone to Amsterdam and come back with some seeds. So at that time, it was what had won the cup. This was prior to even working at High Times. I was at Head Case. We made hemp baseball hats. So went over there, you know, worked a booth at the event and then came home with some seeds and they were the winners. It was Sensi Star and a few of the older strains from back then. White Widow was very popular, had won, I think, around that time as well. So it was chunky, quick indicas that were, you know, had short flowering times. Really, you didn't want anything longer than 50 to 55 days flowering. You wanted it to have bag appeal and be real dense and nice, pretty. But it was certainly a lot of decisions were made on practical purposes rather than sort of aesthetic, you know, effect. NL5 Haze was very popular towards the end, you know, middle to end of the 90s. And now, you know, those were the basis for a lot of the poly hybrids that came afterwards. But yeah, Sensi Star was hugely popular. And I kept a mother of that alive for 10 or 15 years. And it started under that skate ramp.
Oh, wow. So it sounds like you had what we would now call a vertically integrated business. You were producing the product. You were marketing and distributing the product. We've talked about some of the fear and paranoia that can be a part of that, the need to cordon that part of your life off from other parts of your life and take those precautions. What was the what were the fun parts of being that guy back in that era?
Well, I mean, certainly being able to go to a lot of concerts, get backstage, in many cases on stage, but certainly backstage, meeting artists and entertainers and people that, you know, were known entities at that time who were interested in cannabis. And when they come to New York, the, you know, High Times would be where they would for one of sometimes their first stop on their trip. A lot of great fun times. And, you know, certainly going on vacations or traveling to other places and being able to be a part of their cannabis culture, which again was still underground but open to people who were known and trusted. So, you know, being able to go to Vancouver or Northern California, as you and I did during harvest season, and visit people that were harvesting that normally would never in a million years have somebody just pull up and hang out. But for us, the doors were open. That, you know, and meeting the people over in Holland and Spain that kept things alive and pioneered the culture and the industry and new strains and all of that. I mean, a lot of just amazing moments and amazing people. I mean, the cannabis community is just such a amazing community worldwide, getting to be a part of that, having people that, you know, want you to try their homegrown because maybe you inspired them or you helped them out with some type of an issue that they were having. There's no feeling like it. And so, yeah, definitely had a lot of fun times, even just at the office, not even having to leave work. But you know, a lot of amazing memories and mostly just amazing people throughout the world. Some of which you don't share, you know, even a language or any kind of real anything else, but this amazing plant, and yet, you know, they're friends forever.
The first example of that pops to my mind is we were going to Amsterdam every year to work at the Cannabis Cup, and there was a magazine from Japan called Burst High, a place where cannabis is very strictly prohibited. You know, we had somebody translate some of the articles in it for us once, but it was about like kind of like skate culture and graffiti culture and some, you know, sex stuff and all subcultures in Japan. And a lot of it was about weed. And we never broke the language barrier with the people who would come to this event every year from Japan too well. But I can remember spending hours smoking with them and hanging out and laughing. And, you know, that real connection, you know, that J-Dar that we talk about, and that feeling of one, sharing this love of the plant, but also really sharing an understanding of the pain and the stigma of prohibition is really what I think makes those bonds so pronounced sometimes and so quick. And, you know, it occurs to me, I don't really know how you ended up at High Times and how you became the cultivation editor there and a tradition. You know, you weren't the magazine's first cultivation editor by far, but really a unique position, particularly at the time when information about how to grow was much harder to come by. You know, there were no fully legal states. It was the beginning of medical cannabis cultivation. How did you get that job, and how did that change your orientation towards the plant?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I basically moved to New York mid-90s and started growing, and I needed a job to tell people that I had a job basically as a cover. So I started working at Headcase as a shipping manager, basically just packing boxes all day, just wearing headphones, getting high, and shipping boxes of hemp baseball hats to a bunch of different head shops and hemp shops at the time. We made hats for a lot of the jam bands as well, Fish and String Cheese Incident and all of them. So doing that and having Headcase be an advertiser in High Times, I got to know people at the magazine. We were also, like I mentioned, sponsors with vendors at the Cannabis Cup. So I got to go over there and be an actual vendor at a High Times event and got to know people, not least of the reasons were because I had some great bud.
You know, I would say that's like when they say prerequisite minimum, right? 5 years at a, you know, as CEO of a market cap company. This is like at minimum, grow fire weed. You're not getting into the interview without that.
Yeah, it definitely helped for sure. And I, you know, started playing for the softball team. You and I are both alumni of the High Times Bong Hitters. Started playing for that team before I actually worked at the magazine. And then a job opened up. I mean, I was even part-timing it, like answering the phones and breaking down boxes when the receptionist would be out for a day. So I got to be well-known by the staff and ownership. And then basically just when a job opened up, got my foot in the door doing the same sort of thing. I mean, working with products and subscriptions and circulation, and basically did a little bit of everything at the magazine. Got to know kind of how publishing works in a funny way. And then a job opened up around 2004. Cushman, who was my predecessor, Kyle Cushman, moved to California. And, you know, they were like, hey, you know, you can write and you can grow. You know, I was already writing basically on the side. So it kind of was a natural fit. And then I started as a cultivation reporter and worked my way up to editor and then senior editor and wrote a couple of books. And Yeah, had a lot of great times. We started doing cannabis cups in the US in 2010, I believe, was the first one, and had just a really amazing 15 years or so. Yeah, I mean, none of it was really planned out. Like I said, it was like I needed a cover job, and the cover job turned into my real job, and the growing fell by the wayside because I was traveling so much. The cover job took over as my real job. And instead of growing myself, I ended up visiting a lot of grows and seeing how people were doing this in all the hot spots, so to speak.
Yeah. Also, being a grower or a dealer when you are also publicly on staff at the world's only drug magazine is maybe not recommended, although your mileage may vary and certainly
Yeah, I mean,
enough said about it.
there did come a time when the two things were in conflict and I had to pick one. And I had to go with the journalism side. I can't say my luck was running out, but it's tough to quit something like that. But you see the signs, you see the writing on the wall. And I feel like I was able to encourage many others to do that thing as well safely. I hope it wasn't a huge sacrifice for me. I really did enjoy the traveling and all the fun times that we had. At sometimes almost every month we would be in a new place, covering something or putting on a show.
Yeah, not to go all Hunter Thompson on this interview, but I'm going to insert myself in the story for a second, just for perspective. I got a job coming at it more from the journalism angle, having been a journalist, but having been somebody who smoked weed every day from when I was a teenager, who really cared about the plant in a very personal way. But when I took that job, I had seen one, almost imagining what was like growing in the love room, a sort of ill-fated, very small 8 to 10 leaves type plant I had seen once. And this is, I wasn't accepting the job to teach people how to grow weed. I was going to, in those days, really writing a lot about people getting fucked over. Became sort of my beat, and that's something that's really stuck with me. But I had a lot of love for the plant, and I had felt like the plant had helped me in my journey to understand myself and to, hopefully become a better person, really, and to deal with things like depression and anxiety, etc. But if you asked me on day one, do all the different names of strains for weed really mean anything, or is it just a bunch of bullshit? The cynical Jersey dude that I was, who also grew up mainly on and bless them and the people who grew it down in Mexico, but mainly I smoked swag. I was very cynical about it, and I didn't understand it, and I didn't have a frame of reference for it. And Dan, you really took me under your wing and filled in huge gaps in my understanding and my education. And then we were able to go on some just, some of the best adventures of my life, certainly like trips to Northern California, I think in particular, and experiencing that life on a true working off the grid, gray market Humboldt County cannabis farm. It was just like life altering. I think my, you know, to the, I feel like that's why I live in Northern California now, because of that vibe that we caught on some of those early trips.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's also, I should say, it's a two-way street because improved my writing a lot as my editor, and just looking over a lot of stories and changing things around and helping me to basically express things in a more interesting way and a better way. So, like I learned from you as well,
I
for
learned it
sure.
by watching. I'm definitely splicing in
Yeah.
that I learned it from watching you clips, and we'll just react to the end
Perfect.
of that one now.
Perfect.
It's yours?
No,
Your mother said she found it in your closet.
I don't know. One of the guys must have.
Must have what? Look, Dad, it's
Where did you get it?
Dad,
answer me. Who taught you how to do this stuff?
You, all right? I learned it by watching you.
You know, we look back now on our smartphones and you know, remember a rotary phone. Growers of a certain age. and I'm just wondering, like, how you saw the cultivation of cannabis evolve in techniques and methods and genetics over your time from when you first took that job until now.
Yeah, I mean, very interesting, because when I first started, everything was you know, indoor. Anything that was homegrown was primarily indoor. Obviously, people were doing guerrilla outdoor, but the technology was evolving more and more towards indoor, towards hydroponics, towards aeroponics, becoming more and more scientific. And I find that now we're kind of going back to the past, to a more organic living soil, no-till gardening, taking advantage of things like worm farming and beneficial bacteria and microbes, and even the relationship between fungi and mycelium and cannabis roots, and all of that is in a way now viewed as kind of like the future, but also really kind of a way to go back to the past. And all this industrial farming, people need to understand this only started after World War II. There was really not a lot of chemical nutrients and things like that available prior to World War II. And afterwards, they were left with all of this, nitrogen chemical forms that were used basically for bombs and things of that nature that were converted to fertilizer. It doesn't have to be that way. And I think that's what a lot of cannabis farmers are learning, is that the way of nature is the way to go. Also, that the diversity of the plants that you grow makes your garden stronger as well. So a lot of the things I've noticed is a return to the past with some of the newer technologies. So for instance, I don't think the future really is in indoor growing at all. And I don't necessarily even think it's in outdoor. I think it's the best of both worlds, which is a greenhouse, which is climate regulated, takes advantage of the sunshine when you've got it, but you've got light supplementation when you need it. You've got light deprivation when you need it, and you want the plants to flower in the middle of the summertime. And you can grow year round if you control the climate inside of a greenhouse, and a lot of the cost offset by using natural sunshine. But ultimately, I think there's a return to the way things should be in the natural way. And so I've watched it go in the extreme sort of laboratory scientific conditions and all the monitors and things that you need for a hydroponic reservoir, to now people sort of saying, you know what, why don't we use less and less inputs and let our soil be alive and just add to that naturally. So I do think there's been a shift in that way. I think LED lighting obviously has changed a lot of growing, for sure. Even hash production, concentrate production. I mean, it used to be, like I mentioned, we wanted bag appeal and dense buds that flowered, you know, very quickly. Now it's about surface area, because a lot of these hash makers are looking for the quality of the essential oils that they're pulling off of the plant. And so these longer flowering, more wispy plants, which us as growers and connoisseurs, well, not necessarily as growers, but as connoisseurs, we love, as growers, can be kind of a pain. Now I'm seeing a return to that as well. More sativa dominant genetics, more terpene based breeding, rather than breeding for quicker flowering times or bag appeal or density, which really was a symptom of prohibition, because you just wanted to get it done as quick as possible and you wanted to weigh as much as possible. And that's gone away. And we're leaning now more towards cannabinoids, terpenoids, and flavonoids, and how the those things all together with THC, CBD, CBN, and all of those changes the effect and makes it specific to a particular medicinal or recreational need.
Do you see the love and appreciation of outdoor cannabis coming back from the consumer end?
I think so. Certainly more so out west, for sure. But I think so. There's definitely some dispensaries out here and grows that are focusing more on outdoor. There's no recreating the sun. I mean, they try, but the amount, the spectrum, the intensity, there's nothing you can do indoors that replicates all of that. It's a complicated process how these essential oils are created by this plant. And so the sun, can't be beat in that way. That's another reason why outdoor got a bad name, because it's leafy, because it's not getting enough sun. Maybe it's also affected by the environment. And so the dust and the bugs and all of that can be avoided also by having a greenhouse to protect the plants from the elements that could cause harm or damage. So as with the soil, same with the light. People are now, the plant is going from the closet out into the sun, and we're getting the fuller expression of what the plant is capable of.
Absolutely. Well, I wanna kind of wrap up, or roll up, or whatever you want. I got at least one weed pun in there. It's not an episode. I wanna talk about how you are instructing people now and guiding people now in the cultivation process, and what I can kind of, I have a good sense of who's out there listening to this show by now, feeling their vibes, and I feel like, we got some people really excited that, yeah, I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna go for it. But you're listening to this right now, you're probably a little lit. How are you going to feel tomorrow? How are you going to feel in 3 days? How do you keep that excitement going long enough to actually go out and get that soil or find the seeds or the clones that you're going to need? Tell me how you get people to take that first step, to plant that first seed, and why you still find that so satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you mentioned, I've been teaching classes here in New York primarily, but hoping to expand to other parts of the country. Basically, teaching beginner grow classes for people who have never grown a cannabis plant or any plant. I wrote a book in 2018 that's a beginner's guide to growing marijuana. I kind of take people through the book. It's really meant for entry-level grandmother who's never done this sort of thing, or someone, a young person who's just getting into it. And I tell them basically just to keep it really simple. They're going to grow indoors. The easiest thing is just to get yourself a tent purpose-built for cultivation. A lot of times these tents come with equipment like lighting and exhaust fans that go through charcoal filtration to deal with the smell and things like that. And they're light tight. They're easy for one person to put up and down. Again, I don't recommend the expensive plastic hydroponic equipment that some of these tent kits come with. I would say just see if you can knock that off of your bill and just use buckets, 5 gallon buckets or 10 gallon containers, something along those lines. Get your 6 plants in there, veg them out for a month, maybe 5 weeks or so, and then begin the flowering process. So that basically every 3 months or so, you can be harvesting your own homegrown, but keeping it simple, again, just with hand watering. When the buckets get light and you feel like you need to water, you water, but you don't overwater and you don't overfeed the plants. You can always add more, but it's very difficult to take away. So, to me, those are the two biggest beginner problems, is overfeeding and overwatering. So we get those out of the way early.
I love too much, Dan. I love too much.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. People, sometimes you just got to stay out of the way and let the plant grow. If it's doing well and it's healthy, just stay out of the way. You see a little yellowing of the leaves, you see something, a drooping of the leaves, then you can add food or water. But it's always better to err on the side of caution. And start simple. Plant a seed. There, nothing, no book or video or anything can teach you as much as just getting going and getting started. So even if it's just starting with bag seed like I did, I don't know how many seeds people are finding in their weed these days. The other thing is, once it has sprouted, if you're growing indoors, you got to get it under light as quick as possible and not too far away. You don't want a big stretchy plant. So, those are kind of the basics of how I tell people to get started. If it's outdoor and it's in full sun, sometimes you might want to get some shade cloth or something just to reduce the intensity of sunshine between maybe 10 or 11 a.m. and 1 to 2 p.m. when it's at its peak, because that can tend to fry plants too these days. But, hand watering in a light airy mix is really the way to go for beginners, the most forgiving and the simplest way to get started. And everyone should get started if they can, you know, if it's within their, you know, legal and personal reasons to do, then I think it's a great hobby and a really fun time.
Well, it sounds like the journey of 10,000 plants starts with a single seed. It sounds like it starts with just making that commitment to yourself. You know, we always talk about 420 as a time of celebration, a time of reflection. If you've listened to that episode of this podcast about the story of 420, which we repost every year, so it's fresh in the podcast feed for you right now, it's just a true stoner holiday. It wasn't made up by the greeting card companies. You know, now we of course have events and references to it on television, and even your square uncle might wish you a happy 420. But at the heart of it is taking a day, taking a time of year to really express a personal, I'd say, thankfulness to this plant, if it's your medicine, if it's, you know, in the broad sense of medicine, if it helps you in your life, if it's part of your social life, if it's part of your community, if you or people close to you have suffered for this plant, and it's a time to reflect on the need to push back against oppression of all kinds. But I think, gosh, if you could make this 420 the year that you commit in your heart to grow some cannabis, to see what happens, and to say it with me and say it carefully, overgrow the government, it's going to just be more plants, more weed, more happiness, more medicine, more joy, more green life force in the world. That is the world we want to live in. Dan, I just can't say how great it's been to catch up with you. I can't thank you enough for being, I think, my earliest weed mentor, other than the guy behind the bowling alley who smoked me out for the first time. I gotta shout out that guy, too. May many, many beautiful plants flourish and bloom under your instruction and care.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I just want to say to people out there, like we mentioned the stigma, don't let anybody shame you for using this healing flower, which is far safer than alcohol, nicotine, pharmaceutical drugs, even sugar. So, you know, be proud and hold your head high and enjoy the high and share the love too. It's a healing flower and it has great communal energy. So make sure you take advantage.
Yes, cannabis may be mildly habit-forming, but sugar is addictive. And on that note, I will wish all of you, thank you so much for spending your time with us. Thank you for getting high on history with us. Thank you especially to those of you who support the show on Patreon, everyone around the world hearing my voice right now. Have a beautiful celebratory and plantful 420. And we will see you next weed on next Weedness Day for an all new episode of Great Moments in Weed History. Well, that's the show, folks. Thanks so much for listening. And if you stuck around this long, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You could put five on it at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com, and that would really help us as we research, write, edit, and publish a new episode every Weedness Day. Great Moments in Weed History is written, produced, and performed by me, David Bienenstock, a.k.a. Bean. Special thanks to our sponsor, PAX. Go to PAX.com and use promo code GREATMOMENTS, all one word, for a big discount at checkout.